From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We need a break, an economic comeback, a recovery, and maybe, just maybe, we're told it's out there. You can find the numbers, the sales, the indicators, the output to make the case. We always have come back, right? And then there are the doomsayers. You want to write them off, but they were right last time. This hour on point, doom versus boom, now or at least better days for the U.S. economy. You can join the conversation. What do you see coming? Recovery or relapse? The end of the bust or the end of days? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear in this hour from a couple of economists with very different views of where we're headed. We'll report, you decide. But joining me first today from New York is Adam Davidson, co-founder and co-host of NPR's Planet Money. He writes the It's the Economy column for the New York Times. His latest headline ended with a question mark. Is it safe to resume ignoring the prophets of doom, right? Adam Davidson, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks so much, Tom.
So you first of all, give us a sort of little disconcerting tour of how it went last time. Who was right last time and who was not right? And last time it was the doomsayers.
Right, exactly. I sort of recount my own experience as a business economics journalist interviewing in 2005, 2006, these really apocalyptic these economists with apocalyptic visions like Nouriel Roubini, and I talk about this Marxist economist, Richard Wolff, who laid out a very dark view of the future of the economy. And remember, 2005, GDP growth is really healthy, unemployment is at near record lows, the economy is just on fire, doing great. The general view is we have solved the major problems of the business cycle, meaning we're not going to have big recessions anymore. Mm-hmm. We're just going to have sustained growth without recessions, without inflation. And I interviewed these obscure doomsayers. They scared me. I called a few leading economists, and they reassured me that, you know, those guys are a little crazy. I wouldn't pay too much attention to them. And then, of course, it turned out those doomsayers were much closer to right than the conventional wisdom.
So the fringe guys had it last time, Dr. Doom, Nouriel Roubini, and others, while everybody else was just barreling along with the herd and ultimately right over the cliff. So what about this time, Adam? What fringe and otherwise, what's the profile of, you know, doom versus boom or sunnier days look like now?
Well, and one thing I do want to point out is whenever anything unexpected happens, you can go back in time and find someone who predicted that.
Right, the genius, the only one who knew.
The only one who knew, exactly. And I actually read an interesting economic paper that said that anyone who is right during the most extreme times is typically very wrong most of the time.
Okay.
And, you know, Nouriel Roubini did get a lot really right, but he's generally a pessimist. And so, you know, you want to discount him a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the joke goes, you know, he predicted 10 of the last 3 recessions.
Right.
and you know, Richard Wolff is a Marxist. His engagement with capitalism is very complex and hardly one where he's looking for reasons why capitalism is working great.
On the other hand, Adam, I mean, when he says there are structural problems with capitalism, you can open the pages of the Financial Times, hardly Pravda, and they've had a long-running series in there in recent weeks on exactly the same question.
Right. Although I think they're addressing different issues. I mean, I mean, obviously, the Marxist view that capitalism has booms and busts is fairly transparent. I think capitalism's response is yes, but a world with booms and busts actually ends up being much richer overall. Although, you know, no communist or socialist economy has been able to avoid those things either. So, but that's a different discussion. So, I mean, I'll say that right now. The entire economics profession, I would say, has moved decidedly towards the pessimistic, both in the short term, meaning, you know, what's next month going to be like, what's, you know, 2013 going to be like, but also in you know, the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years. There's a new idea called the new normal, which comes out of the very influential bond fund PIMCO,
mm-hmm.
which is that for most of U.S. history, certainly the last century, we've averaged economic growth around 3%, mm-hmm. and we're going to face a sustained period of averaging economic growth closer to 2%. Now, 2 to 3% might not sound like that big a difference, but when you think in terms of long-term compounding interest, that means that our way of life in 2050 would be substantially poorer at a 2% per year growth mm-hmm. than at a 3% per year growth.
Why does a sober, real-world outfit like PIMCO come up with that sense of the whole world shifting to a new and poorer normal?
There's a host of reasons why this might be the case. One is simply that we, as a world, overextended dramatically. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that. You know, we're learning that, and this is, by the way, something Nouriel Roubini predicted in 2005. We're learning that we didn't just have a subprime housing crisis; we had a subprime countries crisis, mm-hmm. where you have, you know, cheap loans going to lots and lots of countries, people, institutions that really were much riskier than the folks thought they would.
Greece on that hook right now, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So Greece really is just an extension of subprime housing, in a sense, or it's the same phenomenon, just in, mm-hmm. in a different manifestation. And that new normal, you hear a lot about that. I'm not going to say everybody signs up for that view, but another view that's related, and I don't think the PIMCO guys would disagree, is that the center of economic influence has shifted from New York to Washington, from the city of London to the European Central Bank, you know, from Shanghai to Beijing. In other words, the economic future is less an outcome of economic forces and more an outcome of political decisions. And for economists, that's very worrying, because the general view is politicians, on balance, overall, tend to make worse decisions. That they either get completely stagnant and stuck, like
right.
our Congress is, or they are very protectionist and are very self-serving, etc. So that is another cause of longer term alarm.
And may go to some of the structural questions. I mean, the other big thing you hear people talking about is state capitalism and how countries that are engaging deeply in that, China, Exhibit A, have been doing pretty well lately.
Right. And there is a rosy version of all of these predictions, but the pessimistic vision is that China has had what's called catch-up growth. They came to the industrialization party pretty late. It turns out it's a lot easier to catch up. In other words, to go from a massive agricultural country to an industrialized country, there's just a lot of low-hanging fruit. You know, China was able to sort of copy technologies and copy things that we in Germany and Japan have been developing for decades and centuries and cram it all into a very short period of time. But many people, I mean, this is untested, you know, no country has ever grown as fast economically yep. as China. We're way out on a branch of that we don't know much about. But the one theory is that you can do that for so long, but eventually you actually need an open society. That mm-hmm. true, you know, entrepreneurial, innovative capitalism requires a free press, a reliable court system, the ability of companies and people to quickly shift gears in response to market forces, and that would require, you know, something like a Chinese Spring, a total transformation of its political system.
Which might bring issues of its own. Hey, Adam, I want to ask you, because we just got a couple of minutes here. The last time out, the fringe guys were on the doom side. I mean, because everybody else was enjoying the party, the Kool-Aid, the Greenspan, you know, Brave New World. Is it possible that this time you've got fringe guys, you quote Ed Yardeni, pretty well-known economist, and he's saying, you know, he's looking at all these bad indicators as sort of room to boom, like housing's down, employment's down, hiring isn't great, but all that means he's talking about double, a back-to-back recovery, like a recovery on top of a recovery, an extraordinary American recovery. Does that just look zany,
right, exactly.
Or do we know?
And definitely the fringiest of fringe views these days is that we're going to have a robust, healthy recovery fairly soon, and things will go very well. But there are, you know, there is evidence for it. You know, we've had a really suppressed housing market, very few people buying new homes, which means there's tons of people in smaller homes than they feel comfortable
yeah.
with, sleeping on their parents' couch,
mm-hmm.
You know, having three kids in a one-bedroom, that kind of thing, and that as soon as there's a little bit of wiggle room, we're just going to have a housing boom again, maybe somewhat of a terrifying thought, but the idea being this one would be based on real, actual need. You know, corporations, as we know, are sitting on huge amounts of cash in the bank, so once they feel just a little bit optimistic, that could unleash huge amounts of money. But I'll tell you, Tom, the lesson I get from all of this is not so much to think who is right. Let's scour the world for the economist who's right.
Yep.
It's actually that thinking any one view is right was one of the things that got us into this mess. I mean, thinking that Alan Greenspan and a handful of other economists had basically figured out how an economy works created a feeling of safety and stability and confidence that turned out to mask very real problems.
The problem is, Adam, and our time is so short here, but for most people, people can plan and try and sort of deal with an economy with some range of, you know, outcomes. But if the range of outcomes is everything from, you know, some kind of double boom on the upside to super bust, doom, pure evil, George Soros is saying now on the downside, you know, how do ordinary people deal with that kind of range?
Yeah, and I'm not here to say this is great news for anybody, but I do think it's just a reality. I think that because of a more globalized world, because of technological advances, for a whole host of historic reasons that are not going to change, the world is much less stable than, you know, the post-war American world in which many of us, you know, that's sort of our model. And probably that means really good news for people in the long term who are nimble and excited by change and embrace it, and it's really bad news for people who really want more stability, etc. And yeah, I don't think there's anything that can be done about it. I
mean, well, we're trying to feel nimble right here. Adam Davidson, you're always great, and we appreciate your insight on this one. Thanks so much for being with us today, Adam.
Thank you, Tom.
Adam Davidson of Planet Money, and It's the Economy in the New York Times. We're talking voices of doom, voices of boom on the U.S. economy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about voices of doom, voices of boom, or at least some blossom on the U.S. economy. Asking if it's a real recovery we've got here, or is it just a respite on a downhill slide? Ben Bernanke, before the Senate yesterday, Senate Budget Committee, talking about the economy, saying it still remains fragile.
The sluggish expansion has left the economy vulnerable to shocks. Indeed, last year, supply chain disruptions stemming from the earthquake in Japan, a surge in the prices of oil and other commodities, and spillovers from the European debt crisis risked derailing the recovery.
Still vulnerable, risk derailing the recovery. And then the Fed chairman talking about, animal spirits in a way here, always important in an economy. He talked about consumer confidence in response to a question from Democratic Alaska Senator Mark Begich. Here's Bernanke first.
Consumers make their spending plans and their employment plans, retirement plans, everything based on what they see in the future,
right,
how they expect the economy to evolve and their own opportunities. If you look at the consumer confidence surveys, people are saying they don't expect to see their real incomes grow. They expect that their financial conditions are going to be flat to down in the next few years. And that's not a situation that encourages people to buy a house or
refinance or
start a business or anything like that.
Consumer confidence, animal spirits, the U.S. economy, the global economy, it's on everybody's mind, and such a wide span of views about where it may be headed. I want to hear a couple of those right here today. With us from Baltimore is Steve Hanke. He's professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Steve Hanke, thank you so much for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And with us from Honolulu, Hawaii, is Brian Westbury, chief economist for the First Trust financial services firm. He's author of, and you can hear it all right here, It's Not As Bad As You Think, Why Capitalism Trumps Fear and the Economy Will Thrive. Brian Westbury, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you. It's last week it was Kansas City. This week it's Honolulu. So,
hey, always someplace new. The eye of the world never stops traveling.
There's a city here, too.
Yeah, I guess so. Steve Hanke, I want to come first to you because, you know, last time out, it turns out it was the doomsayers who were right. And you heard Adam Davidson or may have read him writing about Nouriel Roubini and others. He cites you in there as a doomsayer these days. How doomy, Steve Hanke, and why?
Well, first of all, I'm a contrarian and a trader, as well as an economist, and so that means I can get very bullish about things, and they might be contrary to the consensus. That was the case in Argentina in 1995 when I managed the world's best performing mutual fund. I was the only one buying Argentine bonds, and they went up about 80% in value over the year. So
you chose your time well. What about now?
So now I am on the gloomy side, and the reason for that is the fact that the broad money supply growth in the United States has been negative and very anemic, just barely growing right now. And this is usually puts us in this kind of vulnerable situation that Bernanke was talking about when you played the tape a few minutes ago. So we are vulnerable, and the big threat is Europe, as I see it. And I think there's a very high probability, almost certainty, that Greece will end very badly and that they will not be able to contain the problems coming out of Greece. And that will slop over into the U.S. economy, and the animal spirits will really be soaked with a lot of cold water once that occurs. So I'm anticipating that we could have a recession again. We're now only in a growth recession. We're growing, but at a lower rate of growth than the normal trend rate of growth in the U.S. economy. They call it a growth recession.
Okay.
That's why we're vulnerable, and I think we could dip into negative territory, and I put the if Europe goes south, we've got about a 50% chance of dipping into the negative territory. So that's
could you explain for us, Steve, for us non-economists, on the money supply? Why is it that weak growth of the money supply is a bad indicator for the economy?
Well, people just don't have the money to spend.
And the Fed can't just pump it in?
No. Well, the Fed has pumped since September of 2008 when Lehman went under. The Fed did do a lot of pumping, huge amount of pumping. And the base money, what's called high-powered money, did increase more than doubling since September of 2008. But the problem is it's broad money that counts. The base money is a very tiny portion of the total money in the economy, the total deposits in the economy. And I like to look at the broadest possible measure, which is now M4, and that is just barely growing.
I mean, meaning we're just not generating enough activity to put more coin in more pockets.
Oh, no, yeah, it's the banks. You see, you say, well, where's the difference between high-powered money and then this huge aggregate, which really counts, and that's broad money, and that's the deposits that people have that they can write checks with and so forth, and it's the banks. If banks are not loaning money and extending credit, it tends to mute the growth of broad money.
Why do you think the stock market is up so high right now? If you've got a doom scenario out there, presumably there's some investors who are paying attention, or maybe not. I mean, why would that be up if we've got a recession on the horizon?
I think the markets just have it all wrong. I think they are not focused on Europe. They think they're going to be able to kick the can down the road forever and ever and ever, and it really won't explode. Now remember, just back in December, the stock market had a different tone to it, and it was performing in a much different way than now. Everything was going down, and all the commodity prices were going down, and the dollar was getting strong relative to the euro. Now all of that's changed around, and the tone in the markets is very different, very positive right now.
Yeah, quite true, and you wonder why. We'll dig in on the gloomy side of the equation some more here, but stand by in Baltimore, if you would, Steve Hanke. Brian Westbury in Honolulu, you've got a different view on this. You're saying, you know, we've got to recover here. If it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it's a duck, and it must be a duck. It's a recovery. Why? Why your optimism?
Yeah, I think the number one, well, the reason that I'm optimistic today is I don't ever think –
that in a sense it was as bad as lots of people thought. In other words, back in 2008, 2009, there's this conventional wisdom that has come out of that that says capitalism failed, that there's something broke with the system, and that it can't ever, it won't generate wealth the way that it used to.
Millions of foreclosures, hundreds of billions, a trillion in bailout, people's life savings down the tubes. It felt like the end of days.
I know, and we were told by the government as they spent these trillions that it was the end of days. And by the way, that's another thing about Bernanke today. He is in the mode of easing, and he's not going to see much good about the economy. When Greenspan, which you mm-hmm. talked about with Adam earlier, mm-hmm. Was in the chair, he didn't see anything but good things near the end. There is a bias that takes place at the Fed. It tends to be an organization of momentum, and I think they've been in the momentum of this is a bad economy, we have to save it. But let's talk about the good things that are going on. We're
okay.
just about to have one of the biggest IPOs in the history of this country. We
Facebook.
Have invented the mm-hmm. cloud. We have the smartphone, the tablet. We're doing things in biotech and bioscience that are in oil and natural gas, fracking. The technology that creates wealth. Right now, we are on the cutting edge of some of the greatest technologies the world has ever seen.
Does it still make economic prosperity in the way that we've understood it? I mean, we can all look at the list of Facebook billionaires and millionaires that'll be coming up soon, but that's, what, like a couple of hundred people out of the whole country? Does it work for everybody?
Well, we've created close to 500,000 jobs of people just writing apps. For the iPad, and then you throw in the Android phones, you throw in all the ancillary jobs that those create. I mean, there are now applications where you can, instead of going to the emergency room for $250, you can call a physician on your iPhone for $39.99.
No, I love your list. I think it's great, but we've still got 8.3% unemployment. And if you throw in all the discouraged workers,
sure.
double that or more. So, and we've got Androids and we've got the cloud, but we still got the unemployment. Does that equal recovery? Does it equal prosperity?
You're making, in a sense, you're making, kind of Steve's case. He says he's a contrarian. I don't buy that because there's so much doom and gloom and people can't see the growth. So I think that mm-hmm. the trade with the conventional wisdom right now is to be bearish on the economy. In fact, we've had this growth despite every argument you've just made, Tom, could have been made over the past 2 years. And yet jobs have grown for 23 straight months. GDP is up for 10 straight months. Banks are lending. Commercial industrial loans are up for 13 consecutive months now. Business investment is at an all-time high. Housing, as Adam pointed out, we have not been selling enough homes and building enough homes to replace just what population needs over time. Now, we have excess inventory, but eventually we will work through that.
So how do you pop these numbers?
We have fewer cars on the road today mm-hmm. than we did 3-4 years ago.
Right.
So,
that's pent-up demand. I get that.
Economy like that.
How do you pop these numbers up then out of what Steve Hanke calls a growth recession and into something that would really feel like, quack like the duck of a real robust recovery? Do you see that coming?
Well, I think there's an interesting thing here. If you look at it, 92 out of every 100 people are working today, and I know with 8% unemployment, everybody knows someone or is someone that is out of work, and that always makes it difficult for people to feel like there's a recovery, but. I travel a lot. That's why I'm in Honolulu. This is not vacation. This is business.
Yep.
The airplanes back in 2008, 2009 were not full. The restaurants were not full. The hotels were not full. Now they are. And so I think that, you know, I mean, I don't know how to tell people to feel. People felt like the world would never get bad again in 1999, and they were wrong.
Yeah.
Consumer confidence was at super all-time highs in 2007, and they were wrong. So, you know, the fact that people today don't feel like there's a recovery, I think that's a good sign. I think that's for markets and for the economy, I think that's actually a pretty good sign, because there's a lot of room for people to get more optimistic.
Steve Hanke, what do you make about of that? This sort of, these are the good old days. Snap out of it. You're doing fine.
Well, you see, Brian, my old friend Brian, who's a good supply sider, of course, like me, I guess, is sounding more like a sell-side stockbroker than an analyst here, because if you look at the best measure for aggregate demand in the economy is something called final sales to domestic purchasers.
Okay.
It's this GDP plus imports minus exports minus a change in inventory. And the long-run trend since 1987 for that is about 5.1%. Right now, it's never since before September of 2008, since the start of 2008, it's been below trend, and now it's only 4%, and it's actually going down right now. So if you look at the aggregate demand of all the demand, forget the androids and all of the innovations and everything that Brian is talking about.
We hate to, but okay, for a
second. Aggregate, you just sum it all up, it's very sluggish, below trend. We're not spending and consuming and demanding as much as we do on average over a long period of time. So everything is very weak.
Steve Hanke, Brian Westbury, stand by for a moment. We've got a lot of listeners who are lining up here to get in on this conversation, and I want to begin to bring them in. Let me get David from Williamstown, Massachusetts. David, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, David.
Hey, I'm affiliated with a newspaper, so I kind of have an ear for news, but I was at an event recently, and I was not there to report, but 3 weeks ago at Williams College, Larry Summers, who is the former Secretary of Treasury, as most people know, addressed a sold-out crowd of about 500 people on the campus, and he was talking about the economy, of course. And after talking about two general points, basically, which was to stimulate demand in a Keynesian fashion and also to provide better opportunities for job seekers, he said that we needed to do these two things, and I wrote this down.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, if we are to remain one country, end quote. And I was awake through all of it, but that really sat me straight up in my chair.
And how did you read what he meant by that, David?
I read it. I didn't know how to read it, to be honest with you, Tom, and I was hoping that someone would ask a question. I was not in a place where I could get recognized, and Mr. Summers only took four questions. But anybody who's heard him speak, and this was the first time that I'd heard him speak in public, very measured words. And that's why I'm waiting for the there'll be a video portion that will come out, I think, at some point on the Williams College website, and I want to go back and listen to it. But I certainly didn't take it, for example, as, you know, this will bring together the 99% and the 1%. I just thought it came out of nowhere, and it shocked me.
Well, let's pick it up. We just got a minute before the break, but Brian Westbury, I mean, there's Larry Summers. You know, for to remain one country, we've got to have more, as David reports it, more stimulus. Now, people could say we're already more than one country. We've got such different tiers of wealth and income in this country. But there's Summers making the argument for stimulus to push things up. Do you think, in your sunny scenario, is that needed, Brian?
You know, if you listen to conservatives, they'll tell you if you don't cut government or taxes or regulations, that we won't remain one country or we won't remain a country either. So we've just gotten to this point where everybody's language is very extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Steve is right. I work for a private firm. My constituency is the investor. It's not a Republican audience or a Democratic audience. And the stock market's been up strongly in the last 2.5 years when we've been bullish. And so I feel like I've done a very good job for my customers.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about voices of doom, voices of boom, or at least some blossom on the U.S. economy, asking, is it real recovery we've got going on here? Is it just a respite on a downhill slide, on a troubled horizon? Steve Hanke is with us. He's professor of applied economics at Johns Hopkins University, senior fellow at the Cato Institute, watching very carefully from Baltimore. Brian Westbury is with us, chief economist for the First Trust financial services firm. He's author of It's Not As Bad As You Think, joins us today from Honolulu. Let's go to John in Richmond, Vermont. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom, and hello to your panel.
Hi.
I guess it would be considered an optimist because I see this as, and I don't have, you know, tons of data to support it. I just look at where, how people are looking at the problems. The dire situation has forced people at all levels to look at what they're doing and reevaluate and try to adapt to the reality that's in front of them, whether it's, you know, locally in healthcare or in education or in business. The old tried and true may no longer be valid. You know, at a national level, you're looking at, after decades of stumbling, the automakers are finally making cars that appear to be appealing to the market.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's to me, it reminds me of the 70s, where the Midwest became the Rust Belt.
Not the greatest decade. So why is that a source of optimism?
Well, because what came out of that? We were the Rust Belt. You know, Ford to New York City, drop dead, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And what came out of that were the drivers of the current economy. Intel, Apple, Microsoft, you know, Cisco, you name it. That was unimaginable in 1975.
And yet it came up out of that sump of gloom that many people felt in those years. John, I appreciate your call. Steve Hanke, what about it? I mean, Brian Westbury says, look, we've got all these new technologies that are going to have their fruit. Our caller, John, you know, points to the past and says, you know, when things were gloomy, they were actually accumulating new drivers there that came up to lead us on. Why not that pattern this time, Steve?
Well, the 70s, I don't quite see it the same way that John does, because the one thing that was behind the, shall we say, explosion in productivity that we saw in the 80s and 90s, the seeds were actually planted in the 70s, but John didn't mention, we started deregulating the economy. All the deregulation that started with Carter, really, and Ford, and moved, of course, rapidly with Reagan, and continued with Clinton, that was out of the 70s. That was the great thing of the 70s. Now, some of these other things you've talked about, Tom, I don't think we should be talking about the failure of capitalism. I think that's the wrong thing. I think the thing we had in the crisis is a failure in government. The Federal Reserve and the policies of the Federal Reserve are what really caused the problem to ultimately explode. We didn't just have a housing bubble. We had a huge commodity price bubble that was a result of the Fed allowing the dollar to collapse from the end of 2002 until the summer of 2008. We had huge commodity price increases. And in July of 2008, remember, oil was $147 a barrel. Mm-hmm. Rice prices had hit a world record level. And so the Fed caused the problem. It's still causing problems because people are anxious about what the Fed's going to do. They don't have any credibility. Even the IRS gets higher marks in terms of public opinion than the Fed does. And in Washington, we have a lot of regime uncertainty. People don't know what's really going to happen tomorrow. And we've got, of course, from Massachusetts, we've got the Dodd-Frank regulation.
You're ready just to sort of write off the seeds. I mean, in deregulation, yeah, boom came out of that, but people could say, well, we got bust out of that as well when you see what happened ultimately on Wall Street and elsewhere. We saw, you know, unbelievable instruments on Wall Street that took us into kind of stratospheric rabbit holes we're still trying to climb out of.
This is not, I don't agree with that at all, because we had a situation on Wall Street where we had a lot of regulation. We had huge government failure, you don't think there were regulators swarming over all the banks?
Yeah, in fact, I do not. I've seen the numbers on the SEC, and I know that there weren't, but you've got a different perspective on the Fed. But still, I think our listeners...
The great enabler for blowing the bubbles was the Fed. It could not have happened. Wall Street could not have leveraged as much as they did. They would have not been chasing yield as they were doing and making gigantic bets on very thin prospects for margin, for profits.
Well, it takes two to tango. I'll grant you that. I'll grant you that. Let me get a call from Tom in Fairfield, Iowa. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I want to work the idea of enlightened self-interest versus unrestrained, possibly called greed. And I live in a community that is actually doing very well, has stayed stable through the ups and downs recently. We have two meditation domes. The Fairfield community creates an energy that is documented by the best journals to influence the entire community. But what I want to talk about here is enlightened self-interest, you know, a sense that not just what I want, but what's good for the entire community. And, of course, you know, the general will idea of Rousseau, which kind of found embodiment in Marxism, was let's look out for the whole, whereas capitalism is let's look out for me. Wonder if any of you guys have some comments on the idea of enlightened self-interest versus pure self-interest.
Hey, Tom, we'll definitely look at it. I mean, I assume your economy there in Fairfield, Iowa, has also been floated by good crop prices, and they've been very good in recent years. In addition to meditation domes, Brian Westbury, you know, the Financial Times running this series called Capitalism in Crisis. And I mean, this is right in the heart of the City of London and the whole financial world. But they're, in a funny way, they're singing our Iowa Tom's tune here, saying that excesses drove the bubble and the breakdown. This is from their sort of concluding editorial out of their look at capitalism itself. And they say, you know, when some take risks from which they reap gains, but others face the losses. When many are deprived of opportunities to make their way in the job market. That's not capitalism, but an economy captured by cliques. I mean, how do we get to an sort of enlightened form of capitalism that's going to stay on the wing here, Brian?
Yeah, well, capitalism is capitalism. It's not. It can't be designed. The minute you design it, put rules and regulations on it, it stops being capitalism.
Well, that's hogwash. We had very heavily ruled capitalism in this
hogwash.
Country for all the 20th century.
Now we're playing semantics.
No, it's not semantics. We, you know, I mean,
you're making up your version of whatever capitalism is. I told you what
it's
I
history.
Think it is. So I think it's an organic growth process where people serve other people and they try to make profits, and people that are good at it make more profits than others. And then what happens is that when we go in and, for example, the problems in Europe right now are not because banks are privately owned. It's because government spent more money than they could repay. Now, what happens is banks bought the bonds. So is the problem in Europe because of capitalism, or is the problem in Europe governments that spent more money than they could repay?
Yeah, well, that
so
can clearly come into play.
I would argue that it's the latter, that in fact it's government that created the problem. And by the way, Steve and I do agree, and we don't really have time. I don't think you want to go rehash 2008. But when the Federal Reserve lowered interest rates to 1% back in 2004 and 2005, that was under Alan Greenspan, guess what? Houses look cheaper than they should. And so people want to buy a bigger house.
Sure.
They want to live in the better neighborhood. They're looking at their payment stream and saying, I can afford a bigger house. And I believe that, like Steve does, that the Fed was one of the huge driving forces of the bubble. Now, I'll finish up here real quick, because that's important, because I don't think it was just a failure of capitalism back then. And so when I look at our recovery today, yes, it's not booming. We're not booming like we did in the 80s and 90s. We're not booming like we did maybe in the 50s. but we do have great technologies, and I think one of the key reasons we're not booming like we should be is because we've overspent and overregulated. We are harming the capitalist growth process today, not helping it along.
Well, you're going to have people looking at that from all kinds of angles after the experience that we've had. But let me put this to you. You're our sunny guy here in a way, and here's Corey writing into us. And he says, you know, when we talk about, you know, whether people are optimistic or not about recovery, we need to define it. And he gives two definitions. Let me put them to you, Brian and Steve. He says, you know, here's one scenario. Unemployment claws its way down to 8%. You know, though you've got millions have fallen out of that data because they're just discouraged workers, and you've got cuts at the state level and reduced services and schools that are in trouble, failing schools, he says. Pay and benefits are suppressed. You know, tens of millions never able to retire. That's one kind of recovery. We're maybe close to that one now. Another one, he says, would be 5% unemployment, good schools, you know, stay-at-home moms and dads able to raise kids, retirement and leisure accomplished, you know, higher tax rates on top earners, the American dream. Is that kind of recovery, Brian, within the scope of the brighter scenario that you foresee?
Well, I believe in order to get to that brighter kind of recovery, we have got to shrink the size of our government. You know, if you look at Europe for the last 30 years, forget just the last few years, but all during the 80s, all during the 90s, all during the 2000s, the average unemployment rate in Germany and Italy and Spain and Portugal and was 8, 9, 10%.
Germany?
Yeah, absolutely. And they had unemployment rates that were like we have today in the United States for the last 30 years. And lots of people looked at them as an enlightened society. Why? Because you had long-term unemployment benefits, welfare,
they
had health care systems, they took care of all these people without jobs, and now we're finding out that what we thought was such a great and beautiful picture over there of an enlightened society isn't so fun. And I think the only a social welfare system that proposes to redistribute wealth, it takes away the wealth creation of the technologies that we have.
Boy, but I mean, we're far from what Europe has had, and we've got our own problems here with you know, nothing like redistributed wealth. Let me get a caller on that front. New York City's John's calling from New York. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've been in the restaurant business in New York for 20 years. I'm astounded that we're discussing capitalism and versus fairness. You don't start a football game down 30 to nothing and then start the first quarter. The issue is not inequality. It's called mismanagement of funding by people in business and government. So it'd be great to discuss not whether capitalism is working, it's who's running this operation that is a complete scam. And for the gentleman to suggest, who represents the market, that restaurants and hotels are full, those are ones where rich people can afford to go.
John, who's scamming here? I'm not sure I understand exactly who you think is scamming.
To, again, discuss capitalism as if it has been dealt with in a fair manner. It's fairness, not inequality of wealth. My discrepancy with people who make billions of dollars, God bless them, that's not the issue. It's how we deal with programs, mismanagement of money. How do we get into this debt crisis? Who's running the show? Who's watching the store is the question.
So is it being run? Are you thinking it was mismanaged out of Wall Street, New York, or out of Washington?
I think there's a conglomerate between business, corporate America, and politics. I'm astounded that people don't discuss that economics does, in fact, trump politics. To go around about the political spectrum, it's a joke. It's a joke. People are not represented out of integrity and fairness.
Economics will trump politics. I mean, that has certainly been on the table here, John. Steve Hanke, how about it?
Tom, yep. I think, you know, as the conversation, I'm listening here to the callers and so forth, and I think what we really have to do is look objectively at things you actually measure, like inflation. Is inflation going down? Unemployment. Is unemployment going down? Growth. Is it going up? Interest rates, are they going down? If you look at those four things in the direction that I just indicated, mm-hmm. that means misery is going down. That's something called a misery index. And if you measure that and look at an administration relative to the administration that was there before. We have, since World War II, the administration that reduced the misery index by the most was the first Reagan administration. Then you had the second Reagan administration. They were number two. Then you had Clinton. Then you had Kennedy Johnson. Then you had Clinton again. They all those administrations reduced the level of misery. They reduced inflation, unemployment, interest rates, and increased growth rates. Now, all the other administrations are negative. They increased misery. Now, the question is, what about Obama? This is a current administration.
Well, how about W, just before him, who took us?
W was negative. He was negative.
Yeah, but look where we ended up. Look where we ended up.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
He increased misery.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I'm saying Reagan reduced it, Clinton reduced it, Kennedy Johnson reduced it, and all others increased the level of misery.
We just got half a minute. Do you see a way out of that hole now? What's the way out of that?
The thing I'm trying to point out is you can objectively measure these things that we've been talking about with something called the misery index. And you look at Obama, the worst administration we ever had, back to John's call on the 70s, was Carter in the 70s. Nixon and Ford was almost as bad. It was a complete disaster. And now I'm estimating the next one up from the bottom, third from the bottom, will be the Obama administration. And then right above that was the second Eisenhower administration.
Yeah, well, we're trying to look out of that hole, and it's hard to do. It's hard to look up over the rim. But we all lived through the process that put us in the hole in the first place. Hasn't been pretty on either side, but it's been interesting today. Steve Hanke at the Cato Institute and Johns Hopkins University, joining us from Baltimore. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Brian Westbury with First Trust Financial, author of It's Not As Bad As You Think. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.